Hi, everybody. Ron Placone here from the Indie Bohemians Morning Show, and here is my interview with Craig Finn. Craig Finn is probably best known for his work with The Hold Steady, but he's doing a lot of solo stuff now. We talk about his first solo record and the solo record he's got coming out soon. It was a wonderful chat. We met at a coffee shop in East Nashville. We talked about literature. We talked about songwriting. We talked about music. We talked about punk rock and hardcore movements in the 80s and 90s. We talked about the DC hardcore movement. We talked about Minneapolis. We talked about The Replacements. We talked about why he doesn't like Jim Morrison. We talked about how the Hold Steady handled the comparisons to Bruce Springsteen and thoughts on that. We talk about spirituality. We get into a lot of stuff, and we just kind of sit outside at a cafe having this conversation. It was a nice day. You can hear the birds chirping. You hear the occasional car starting. At one point, this girl needed the garbage can, so she straight up just interrupted the podcast. That's not in here, but that happened, and Craig laughed about it. He was a really fun guy to talk to. Had a really nice time chatting with him. Without further ado, please welcome to the show Craig Finn. So I'm here with Craig Finn, and the rain has cleared up, man. This is, something's on our side today.
The sun's out. I think that was just a brief shower.
Yeah, had a brief shower here in East Nashville. Now it's nice. We're sitting enjoying the sun, chatting about some things. So talk a little bit just about kind of your, because your story I've always just been interested in because, and these are your words, you went out to Brooklyn and were going to be a dude.
Yeah, I was going to be a dude. Well, I was married at the time, and I had a band in the 90s in Minneapolis called Lifter Puller, and it broke up, and I was getting a little restless in Minneapolis, and I wanted to go to a bigger city, and New York is where kind of I knew the most people, and it was the most exciting city to me. So I went there, but I thought I'd get a job and just kind of work, you know, and be a dude, and, I didn't want to be in a band. I didn't want to be on tour. Part of the thing was, the band I was in, Lifter Puller, in the 90s, it was a small level. We booked our own shows. We drove to these shows in vans. Not many people showed up. We didn't even have a booking agent, you know? So it was kind of I was kind of exhausted about it. I would book our shows from the payphone bank in the lobby of my day job, and then we go out on these tours on my like vacation from said day job, and so it was kind of exhausting. And then also, you know, you learn a lot about like your van, you know, like there's the van's always breaking down and there's always a lot of stress, your gear doesn't work, so there's this like lower level band stress that was kind of had me a little bit exhausted. So anyways, I went out to Brooklyn, and I moved to Brooklyn in September 2000, and got a job, and was just kind of being a dude, you know? I'd go to shows, I'd write songs still, because I always written songs, but I was just kind of doing that for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So what led you then to the progression? Because then, of course, the Hold Steady happened.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you're kind of doing some stuff on your own, but it seems like, you know, for years and years you were never that guy. But it seems like the way you write songs, that's such an obvious thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've always written songs, and so the songs were kind of starting to pile up. And then I met this guy who was doing a comedy thing. And they had this comedy troupe, it was a four-piece, called Mr. Ass. And the guys...
Was this in New York?
In Brooklyn, okay. Yeah. And one of them wrote I still had the website for Lifter Puller. My band had like a email address, and one of them wrote me and said, I love your band. I live in New York. If you ever want live in New York, we should get some food. And I said, well, you know what? I live in New York now. And, you know, I'm looking to meet people, so I met them. And he had this thing he was doing, and he asked, well, would you put together a band and do some covers at this thing, you know, because and I was like, oh, that sounds fun, you know, I was kind of like, that sounds low stress. And so Tad, who was in Lifter Puller, had just, this is about 2 years in, 2003 probably, had moved to, no, it was 2002, sorry, he had moved to New York then, and, I got him because he was really good. He could play like every song ever. So it's like, if we just get him. And then the other guys, Judd and Galen, were friends of ours. And we got together and did this thing, you know, the comedy thing. And we did, like, I can't remember. We did, like, Moon Age Daydream. We did Are You Ready for the Sex Girls from the Revenge of the Nerds. Each of the guys in the four guys in Mr. Ass each sang a song. And then they were like, well, do you guys want to play one of your own songs at the beginning? At the top of the show. And I was like, well, we don't really have any, but actually I have a song we could learn. So mm-hmm. we learned Knuckles, which is on the first Hold Steady record, mm-hmm. and played that. And then after we did one or two of those, we were like, it'd be more fun to play our own songs. So we started doing that. And then we had this, the thing was, is with the Hold Steady, we played, there's this other thing that happened in the years I wasn't doing anything, is kind of the internet happened. The internet was already invented and active, but it started kind of kept getting bigger, and especially in regards to people talking on it, I think. Mm-hmm. And Lifter Puller became kind of a thing that, oh, you had to be there, you had to have seen it, no one saw it. And a lot of people, there was a market for it, sort of, people who never saw Lifter Puller, but who had now heard the music, mm-hmm. Who were like, oh, I can't believe they broke up without ever me seeing it. You know, and I was getting photos of people, like, getting Lifter Puller tattoos who had never seen the band and stuff, you know. So there was this cult thing happening. So then we started playing, and the first Hold Steady show was in Brooklyn, January 2003. And there was, like, not a ton, but, like, for a band's first show, there were, like, a fair amount of people that, like, I didn't know. You know, they weren't like your friends from work or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it sort of had a life right away. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a little struggle in the Hold Steady compared to Lifter Puller.
Well, one of the things that, you know, in your lyrics, whether it's the solo stuff or the Hold Steady stuff, there's this very heavy sense of place. Mm-hmm. So how did it affect your song? Because, I mean, even in the Hold Steady, you sing a lot about Minneapolis. You uh-huh. sing a lot about your old stomping ground. Yeah. And I can't help but hear a lot of your music whenever I'm in that town.
Yeah,
And so how, like was it different for you, like, orchestrate all that stuff, but being in actual Brooklyn?
I think in when I moved to Brooklyn, I was funny. In Lifter Puller, I sang about Minneapolis a lot, too. But honestly, I sang about New York more in Lifter Puller than I did but when I moved in New York, I realized what a unique place Minneapolis is, and sort of like the kind of unique people that we knew there. And the other thing was there was a real sense of scene in Minneapolis when I was there. You know, there were like these bands that would play together, and there was a real tight-knit community, even cross genres. You know, we knew hip-hop bands and real heavy punk bands, and everyone kind of sort of was in this thing. So I think one of the things about the Hold Steady, I started singing about a scene, kind of. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to start it with a positive jam. Things like that were about this scene coming together, which I realized, I think, especially when I moved to New York, that was very unique and something that not everyone had.
Mm-hmm. Well, how, because that's something else I wanted to ask you. I mean, you mentioned Youth of Today, mm-hmm. the early 7 Seconds. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all stuff that you sing about. Musically, what you do is quite different than that. But there's still, like, a connection there. How would you kind of explain that connection, especially for someone that may have missed that initially?
Well, I think I grew up really interested in punk and hardcore music. And in, you know, especially in, like, when I was in high school, I graduated high school in 89. So, you know, Youth of Today and the Gorilla Biscuits and sort of this East Coast straight edge scene of the 80s, who sang a lot about, and Bad Brains and Cro-Mags, sang a lot about positivity. And I was really into going to these shows and, you know, singing these songs with a bunch, almost all dudes, about positive, you know, positive youth. And it's actually very interesting to me because everyone involved was under, you know, 20. Mm-hmm. So the fact that, you know, these kids from Connecticut and Youth of Today, say, could get in a van and drive to Minneapolis without any sort of adult supervision and go to some place, some VFW hall or whatever, and 300 kids would show up and sing their songs. It's almost cultish. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me. There was no hand of the industry kind of in there. It was a very organic thing. And I think that's been fascinating to me. So all that hardcore stuff was another thing. It was part of a scene. And, you know, I think that's always been interesting to me to kind of, and the positivity, thinking about rock and roll as something that's not about, you know, cigarettes and leather jackets and delinquents or something, you know, but it's a real positive force, you know, mm-hmm. because rock and roll was, to me, a positive thing. I think in some ways it saved my life, you know, it gave me some meaning in some dark times when things were, you know, when I sort of, it let me know that there's other things out there. And so I saw it as this beacon of positivity and started singing about that. And the hardcore thing, it acts as a connector because a lot of people around our age came up with punk and hardcore kind of get that reference and be like, oh, I know what he's talking about, you know? And maybe that's not like what they listen to right now, but it's part of their past.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then the track No Future, is that a bit tongue-in-cheek? Or?
Yeah, I mean, No Future is like, I mean, well, there's two things. Obviously, there's the Sex Pistols, No Future,
right.
And then there's the Titus Andronicus song, No Future, who are friends of mine, and so it was kind of a double nod. But but yeah, I mean, No Future is sort of just this ultimate nihilist statement that I don't know. Some of this stuff, you know, some of this stuff. It kind of has to make me laugh first.
Yeah.
And that for some reason, that just kind of, it gave me a chuckle. And that, you know, that song ends with a Minneapolis reference, and Devil's a Person. I met him at the Riverside Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
Riverside Perkins was, you know, Perkins restaurant. Like it's like a Denny's kind of.
Yeah, I've been to a Perkins.
Yeah. So the Riverside is a street in Minneapolis. And, you know, back before there was a lot of late night dining options in Minneapolis, that was where you went after the bars.
Mm-hmm.
And so there'd be just all kinds of craziness going on at the Riverside Perkins.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, one of the things, like, you mentioned, like, that has the Sex Pistols reference, and then you have, and I think that's part of the reason I enjoy that track so much, because, like, there is that, like, nihilistic thing, but for anyone that's familiar with you, I feel like they're just going to kind of laugh at that, because you're so far from a nihilist. I mean, because all these things that you know, John Berryman, Joe Strummer, Sex Pistols, the list goes on, and I think, you know, a lot of your audience, they're going to discover this stuff. Because
mm-hmm.
of some of your music and stuff, so that's like as far from a nihilist as you can get in so many ways.
Yeah, well, I mean I'm certainly not a nihilist. I'm an optimist. But you know, making that reference in some ways like a joke, and like I said, it's a Titus Andronicus thing too. So it's a joke two ways, and you see who gets it, and you see who comes back at you with it, and you know, I'm also in that song. I talk about Freddie Mercury, which is
mm-hmm.
you know, who is decidedly not punk, but I think very positive.
Oh, absolutely. So, it costs $10 to get in the door, it costs more to get in touch.
Yeah.
Expand, please.
Well, that song's on Balcony, and that song is about
mm-hmm.
going to a party where, you know, things happen, going to a sort of, and that girl goes away with a guy. He comes with a girl and he leaves without her, and she meets someone at the party that she likes better, who's, you know, I think kind of a druggy guy, you know, costs $10 to get in this party. You know, it's kind of like a house party that costs $10 to get into is like, well, what's that about? Can I just come in to your house? So, I mean, but it's kind of like this idea that you have entree to things if you get into that party. And, you know, it's like things in your 20s that, you know, bend to things like that. And, That you know, if you got in this, if you went this one place, things would be available.
Yeah, no, I had an emotional response to that, like a strong emotional response to that, and the way like I digested it was, you know, like we've talked a little bit on this and then off mic about, you know, we have somewhat similar lives, a touring comic
mm-hmm.
and a touring musician, and what I thought of that is I thought the, you know, so many of my friends, you know, we live in different places now. We're all on the road. We're all doing different things. Some of us are writers now. Some of us are out of the industry altogether. And, you know, the whole idea of it costs $10 to get in the door, costs more to keep in touch. It made me think about, you know, you get 1,000,005 Facebook invites and 1,000,005, like, things like this about your friend's band, your friend's show, your friend's this. But when it comes to, hey, I'm in your town, can we get a cup of coffee? You got a 30-70 chance.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it is that extra, it's that, just getting in the, it's that level of commitment, right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you can click, you know, on your internet, whatever you're trying to do, your band or your comic or whatever, you can get so many likes or so many favorites, but if you can say, can you come down to the show tonight? Like, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, you know, I can like you all day on this screen, but like, can I get off the couch and go do it? It's different, right?
So I mentioned John Berryman, but, you know, whenever I listen to your music, the solo stuff or whatever, you know, it's always like I sit down and it's like Craig Finn's telling me a story now.
Mm.
So what other kind of literary things would you want to point to?
Well, I mean, I've always been a huge reader, so, I mean, it changes daily. And I love, like, there's this thing when you get into a novel. I think Franzen wrote an essay on this that said, it's like a really serious form of meditation, because if you have a novel you're reading and you're lost in it, you're not thinking about your own problems, you're thinking about this character's problems, and that's really profound. That's a break from your life that I don't think you get from TV or movies or anything. I think reading, just the act of trying to digest the words, maybe kind of gets you deeper. But, you know, stuff I love is like, I mean, a lot of modern authors are sort of Rousseau. Larry McMurtry is something I absolutely love. He has so many books, and so many of them are great. And they're not, like, super heavy, but they're really, there's some amazing ones. I just gave a gift, All My Friends Will Become Strangers. It's, like, one of my favorite books about being a writer. But, I mean, I read a book last year called Fourth of July Creek that was just fantastic, and there's always stuff coming in and out that I love, but I'm always just kind of reading, and I'll read a book that I find in a hotel, you know, just because if it comes up at the right time, I don't have something to read, I'll start reading it.
Right. Yeah. You always have to have something where you just feel like you're like, I'm not living right now.
Yeah. Right. I need, especially as a, you know, touring musician who's walking around like trying to kill some time before sound check or whatever. It's like, you don't have some sort of book you're working on, it gets pretty bleak.
You library guy?
I do library sometimes. My library by my house is somewhat limited, so I do really tend to prefer to read fiction.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm it's always limited by its fiction department, but I go to the library.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of I do a lot of Kindle, and quite honestly, this doesn't seem romantic in some way, but living in New York, I do a lot of Kindle app on my phone.
Really?
And I'll just read on my phone on the train, you know?
Like, yeah.
You know, because rather than carrying a book around.
You're okay with it?
It's not my preferred method, but okay. It's better than staring into space.
Sure.
You know?
No, I have a hard time. I mean, I'm still that guy. I have to have the physical pages and stuff. I haven't made, I don't know if it's a Luddite thing or not. Like, I don't know what it is.
I mean, I prefer it, you know, and I think it goes better. Like, it goes better. I tend to enjoy myself more if I'm reading an actual book. But, you know, it's sort of whatever gets you through.
I just like to, like, just more easily go back, see the printed word, point at it, touch it. And sure. I'm occasionally a marking up guy. Are you the occasional marking up guy?
Yeah, I do that.
Can't do that with a library book.
I do. No, right. I'm also at this point, and this is, again, it's a convenience thing. Maybe I'm easy on convenience. I'm also, like, I do have a record player in my house, but I listen to a huge percentage of my music on my iPod and on headphones, you know, walking around.
Have you ever, when you write, do you ever just straight up start with lyrics, or do you always start with lyrics, or how does that usually?
It can happen different ways. You know, with the Hold Steady, it's usually Tad bringing in music and then, you know, playing me a riff, and then I usually have notebooks that I, like, written in, and I'm like, oh, this will go with that riff, and then we kind of, like, fit it together. But, you know, the solo stuff where I'm writing the music more, it might start a little more with me strumming guitar and coming up with a really simple chord progression that, you know, my solo stuff, since I'm writing the music too, it might come with me just starting with a very simple chord progression and building on that. So it can happen anyway. It doesn't always, but a lot of the times it does happen with the first line. You know, rather than, I certainly would never be the guy, I never would have, like, the chorus first. I don't know that that's ever happened, because I don't think, to me, like, the first line, the entry point of the song is almost more important. Or certainly the thing I usually come up with first.
Okay, so you literally start it like an essay almost.
Yeah,
like
just, yeah. The chorus can kind of reveal itself. I mean, the thing is, like, you know, especially when you go solo and you're not in a band or it's like a little quieter, people always want to talk about songwriting. And, you know, here we are in Nashville. People mm-hmm. always want to talk about songwriting. There's this one thing that happens with, like, indie musicians that I'm kind of reluctant to join, is where, you know, your band, you do a solo record, and then all of a sudden you declare yourself a songwriter. And, I mean, if you go on Twitter, there's all kinds of these guys who are talking about lazy songwriting and etc., you know, and it's like, I don't know if that I'm interested in songwriting so much as I'm interested in making something that's cool, you know? Mm-hmm. Meaning, like, I don't really care if the chorus has to come in 45 seconds to be a, you know, true song or something. People have these conversations, and they're just not that interesting to me. Like, I think, like, you know, a song can, you know, a 90-second song can be awesome.
Yeah.
And a song without a chorus can, too.
There's that hardcore speaking again.
Yeah,
a 90-second song can be awesome.
Yeah, and I don't really think that, like, you know, constructing a song like someone, like, you know, for a pop musician, Taylor Swift or whoever, is, I don't think there's anything wrong with it if that's what you want to do, but I don't think there are, I hear people talk like that's what you should be doing always, is creating these songs, you know,
yeah.
that are like songwriting is this one thing, this you know, trying to find perfection. It's like, I think it can just be like an expression of emotion that maybe it's not trying to be a hit song at all. It's maybe it's only going to appeal to like 9 people, but it's still true to itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think especially here, I mean, you know, a lot of my friends, you know, they'll be session guys, they'll be like, you know, guys on Music Row trying to pitch whatever.
Yeah.
But they do that to pay the bills so that they
sure.
have the time to do the other stuff
yeah.
that, you know, that you're talking about. And I guess the ultimate goal is to get to that point where that is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking like, you know, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, that's a good song to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on forever, you know? Like, that's not anyone's idea of a pop song, you know? But it's pretty good. It's really good. It's great.
So talk a little bit about your, because there's a lot of spiritual stuff going on in your stuff as of recent. And you've mentioned before in public your reconnection with Catholicism. Speak a bit to that, because I have a similar background too. I was raised Catholic. I've
yeah.
since walked away. But.
Yeah, I was raised Catholic, and you know, I've always kind of been back and forth. Today I'm back, and I'm always going to be back and forth. And I find some beauty in church, especially in the act of going to church. Going to Mass is really awesome.
Why?
I don't know. I feel like it's like a very it's a step out of life and into a real place where you can think, relax, at least for me, and reflect, you know, not just on, you know, the scripture or, you know, Christ, but also on my family, you know, the Catholics that came before me, which is my dad, my grandfather, and, you know, the time spent around and how we, and, you know, if you really, it doesn't take much to find beauty. In the scripture and church, it doesn't take much to find the awful parts. Also, it's the problem, and those are easy to think about. And you know, I don't go to church as regularly as I wish I would go, because I do get something out of it. But I, you know, I don't go more than once a month probably now. It's sort of inconvenient that it's on Sunday mornings.
Right.
But no, I like it, and it is something profoundly inside of me, and how I sort of the world, you know, it still is part of how the world I explain the world to myself, and I don't know. There's someone on the internet said something recently that I saw. I can't remember what it was in regards to. It was like, you can't pick and choose parts of religion, and I'm like, why not, you know? Like, I sort of feel like saying, like, well, I'm kind of a weird Catholic is a better way of dealing with it than me trying every church in America and trying to find the one that works perfect, that's going to line up perfectly with me.
Yeah.
My politics are completely off with the Catholic Church in most cases, but...
Even with the new guy?
He says
some nice things.
He says some great stuff. I think what I do believe is that what the Catholic Church can be in 2015 and going forward is it really can be a bridge to helping poverty. And I believe that they can be effective in that. Mm-hmm. And that's what they should be concentrating on.
Yeah.
Not, you know, this morality or trying to tell people what to do in modern America, you know? But I think there's a lot of poverty in this world that they could be putting resources towards. And I hope that's what they'll do. And it feels like that's what this Pope knows.
Yeah, I think so, too, because, I talk about this some on my show and mm-hmm. stuff, and, you know, and I mention how, I was raised this way, I don't really practice anything, whatever. And somebody commented, and they were like, you know what, whether you want to admit it or not, when it comes to principles, you've still retained a lot.
Right.
Principles of charity and peace, and when you kind of strip away the kind of, I don't know if you want to call it morality, fluff, whatever you want to call it, when you strip that stuff away, you know, those core principles are great and really, you know, I think probably shaped me a lot as a person.
I mean, well, it's kind of like, you know, if you have a kid, I don't have any kids, but if you do, it's like, you know, you can, there's something about taking them to Sunday school or something that, like, it's nice to have these conversations about morality, charity, things like that. Which sort of seem like if you have any 3-year-olds in your life, if you have to have those conversations, it's going to end up with a lot of why. So it's not the worst place to have someone dealing with that for you.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then as they get older, it's like you have all these kind of questions that we just can't answer.
Right.
And I feel like just sort of a lot, like all religions, it's not like this is unique, but I feel like all religions, they just keep trying to explain that which is so inexplicable, and eventually you just get this web of absurdity.
Yep, yeah.
And then it's like, well, how do you, what do you do?
I mean, accepting the mystery is sort of a good thing, you know? Like, well, this is part of it. It's a mystery. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
This is our own best efforts, kind of to guess, I guess.
So, here's something contemporary. What are your thoughts on the Replacements allegedly calling it quits again?
Well, it doesn't entirely surprise me. Anyone knows the Replacements knows there's generally been a lot of chaos. And I was really glad they came back and did these shows. I was lucky, Hold Steady was lucky enough to open for two of them, Minneapolis and New York, which were kind of the big ones. And I saw them in Boston, I saw them in Chicago, and they were great each time. And it felt like, for me, just a celebration of it. It was so nice. I felt like the crowd went into these shows, and Minneapolis was a very special one, but so was New York. But, you know, Minneapolis, it's funny, Minneapolis, which is, I think, kind of a Puritan town regarding alcohol. You know, there's a lot of kind of heavy liquor laws, like you have to buy beer at the liquor store, they close at 10 p.m., etc. But somehow you were allowed to tailgate at the Replacement show starting at 4 p.m. And I just walked out in the parking lot, and there was like all these cars with their doors open, blasting a different Replacement song of each car, which just made for a sea of white noise.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this guy used to work with a martini, you know, in a glass with an olive. And I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be something else. But it felt like when we all went into that show, it was a way, because obviously there's way more people there at the show than the crowd they've ever played with before in their, you know, first run. It felt like a time that we are all able to, like, show people show them how much their music meant to us, you know,
mm-hmm.
and how much these songs meant to us. I mean, if they broke up, that's fine. If they're not going to do it again, they're fine. They certainly played a lot of shows, and I feel like their fans got to see them a few more times, and you know, I think they're probably serious. It seems like they're, you know, travel never seemed like their thing. They ended in Europe, which, you know, they hadn't spent a lot of time there in their normal career. And that's you know, heavier travel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's got its own, everyone's got their own set of things. But I'm just glad, I'm really glad they did it, and I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah. Well, had you crossed paths with them at all prior to getting
Yeah, I mean, I knew Tommy a little bit. And I'd met Paul, so, you know, not a ton. I don't know either of them super well, but, you know, they are my favorite band, and I saw them a lot, you know, a few times growing up, including some shows in First Avenue and 7th Street Entry, some small places. So they're a huge part of me wanting to be in a rock and roll band. They're mm-hmm. my favorite band growing up, and they were so cool, you know, and they had these great songs. They had these great songs that were like both things, you know. They were like these bordering on hardcore punk rock kind of heavy songs and kind of funny songs. Gary's Got a Boner, Tommy Gets His Tonsils Out, and then all of a sudden these just beautiful ballads like Unsatisfied or 16 Blue that would just break your heart. And they were kind of like, I guess that's what I loved about the Replacements, had this hard shell and the soft center almost that was really appealing to me when I started trying to write songs of my own.
So I've read some stuff in regards to what you said, getting to another group that I wanted to talk to you about, Jim Morrison.
Oh.
You've had some things to say, that, and I gotta say, I'll confess, I'm a Doors fan. I was a little, not surprised in a bad way, just, I wanna,
yeah.
So expand I will, if you would.
Here's how I'll expand. It's funny, because that comes from a time when the Hold Steady was coming up, and you'd see, you get to do a lot of interviews, you know, and it was sort of before I was that savvy about things, and they'd say what's a band you don't like,
and I'd say, really? They would just straight up be like,
we're doing a thing on, what's your least favorite band, you know?
See, I feel like that's lazy interviewing.
And then you say well, I don't like Jim Morrison, you know, he seems like sort of a, you know, kind of a drunk poet, you know, the drunken Jim Morrison is the one I don't like, you know, or the revered for sort of this, I don't know. But then it shows up in print, and then I think it's it's taken, you know, then it starts, because the internet, it starts regenerating, and you're
right.
I wish I wouldn't have said that, not just because I don't like to be negative about musicians live or dead, but you know, that's not my favorite classic rock band. I think there's something meandering about it, but then that said, there's songs I really like, so you know, but I think it seems when I was growing up anyways, unpunk.
Okay.
But so did Led Zeppelin, and I've really come around to, it was my 20s before I loved Led Zeppelin, and now it's I can listen to nothing but Led Zeppelin for weeks, but you know, I think that there was something that thought the Doors were kind of decidedly unpunk in some way, which is, I mean, the funny thing is that you know, you go back and see X, you know, the LA band X,
mm-hmm.
they are very connected with the Doors,
yeah.
And they're one of my favorite bands in the
world.
Ray, so, yeah, Manzarek
produced,
yeah. So, you know, you get a little perspective on this, and you're like, well, yeah, I see, that's cool. And then, you know, Touch Me is a song I've always loved. And
yeah, well, no, I was just curious, because I agree, there's some skeleton in those closet,
yeah.
I think, because they produced a lot in such a short amount of time, there was substance abuse going on.
Yeah.
But then it's you know, Riders on the Storm Mine, I'll agree, that's not very good. But 5-1.
The brain's squirming from, this may have had how it come up. His brain is squirming like a toad.
Yeah.
It's a line I don't like. I don't either.
I'll agree.
Yeah, that wasn't. But you know, it's funny because you would say you see, and the English press, especially, there was a time when I was doing a lot of press in the UK, and there they love that. That, you know, they're like, what's a band that you don't think has aged well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you say it, and then you're like, oh no. And then all of a sudden, you know, there was, you know, you say something, and then all of a sudden, that's the headline,
mm-hmm.
in the NME, you know, Finn slams Band X, you know, and
yeah.
then it's like, and then it sort of creates its own, you know, and then the comments section, you know, et cetera, everyone gets involved. And it's just part of the way they do things. I think the way music journalism is overall now, maybe journalism, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you see you still see that, and I've seen bands that are younger than me, I see where they kind of are, I'm much more aware of it now, so I try not to get involved in those kind of things. Just because it's not, I mean, maybe you're supposed to, maybe if you're Noel Gallagher, it's a good idea, you know, because it keeps you in the papers. I mean, I think
you want to get that kind of press.
Well, he's really funny though. I mean, his interviews are amazing. So, I love when he does it. You know, but it's just not my personality.
Well, one of the things too, when Boys and Girls came out,
mm-hmm.
You know, really quick, and I personally, I thought that this was lazy on behalf of the press, too. You know, the Springsteen mm-hmm. comparison started coming. But I really liked the way you guys, it seemed like you kind of took that and wore it as a badge and forced people to kind of see through it, because it was kind of a lazy observation in many ways. Was that intentional, or was that planned, or was that just because you liked the guy?
I mean, I liked Springsteen, and he is an influence, so it was mm-hmm. like, I mean, for me to say, like, what are you talking about, or nothing like, but, you know, I would just say, yeah, it's in there, you know? Mm-hmm. There's other things in there, too.
Right.
I mean, I've listened to probably... you know, I've listened to 2 hours of Replacements for every hour of Springsteen I've listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be in there, too, quite a bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think the piano at the time in rock and roll led in the storytelling kind of nature of it. And I guess in our song structures, we had kind of led towards the epic, you know, the mm-hmm. bridge where the piano goes down to the piano
breaks, yeah.
and then it kind of builds up and something kind of anthemic at the end. So it was very influential. And, you know, the other thing about that that makes it not a bad comparison is, that, again, it's something you brought up, the connection to a place, the way that, you know, Bruce sang about the place he was from.
Yeah.
And we did too, you know, and, you know, tried to make Minneapolis our own, or Minneapolis is my own personal jersey, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot worse things than being compared to Bruce Springsteen. It's ultimately what I decided, you know?
So what's your thoughts on Minneapolis today then? Do you still get back some or no?
I do get back probably like 2 or 3 times a year, and I love it there. I love it better not in February.
Mm-hmm.
It's very cold. But it's really nice. My family's, you know, mostly still there, and I really enjoy it. It's one of those things though, like, I go, people, like touring musicians, people I'm friends with, are like, you know, what should I do in Minneapolis now? And I'm like, I don't know. I lived there last in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I know you go to First Avenue, it's the greatest club in America, but, you know, if they aren't having anything tonight, I'm sort of at a loss. So I don't feel like totally on the pulse of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I do really like being there, and it's still just a great town. And summer in Minneapolis, because I think, you know, it's so cold there during the winter.
Right.
When it's summer there, it's just glorious, you know? Like, everyone's so outdoorsy, and it's so pretty, and there's just a great, great feeling. Like, a summer Saturday in Minneapolis is a spectacular thing.
Well, the one thing that, you know, I celebrate about places like Minneapolis is that, yes, it gets blisteringly cold, in my opinion, almost unfit for humans.
Yeah.
But the city, and I think Minneapolis is the greatest example maybe in the United States, they know how to embrace it. They play in it. They know how to clear the roads. They have the indoor walkways. It's just sort of ingrained. And you guys just have alcohol and killer diners and poutine. And it's just like, so I mean, do you think maybe like growing up there kind of like gave you, like do you think maybe that indirectly influenced the sense of place you always have?
Yeah. I mean, well, you knew, you know, my parents are from Massachusetts. So like their connection to Minneapolis, they loved it. They loved, you know, my dad's still there. My mom passed away. But they, I always knew it was like one step towards crazy or something, you know, because my relatives in Massachusetts were like, whoa. Even though Massachusetts isn't necessarily a warm place either, but mm-hmm. they were like, this is insane, you know. So I always felt like we're living somewhere kind of frontier-y and unique. And I went to college in Boston. I came back and I sort of was like, okay, well, I just, there is something special here. It's hard to put, I think it's part of what you're talking about, the weather. There's also, I sort of believe that there's a thing in Minneapolis where people sort of want to, there's a progressiveness, I think, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of bicycle, I think I read it was like the most bicycle friendly city, which is crazy when you think that it's under ice for 6 months.
Right.
But you know, the commitment to the arts there, First Avenue, I think, is one of the most amazing things ever. The club, First Avenue, which is, you know, That and the 930 Club, I think, are probably the best clubs in the United States. 930 Club in Washington, D.C. First Avenue, you know, rock clubs come and go. I've seen them come and go.
Sure.
They don't have long lives. First Avenue is older than me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It started in 1970. So to have that kind of foundation for a music scene in town, and, you know, such a an audience for music in that town that's you know, had Prince, The Replacements, Husker Du, Soul Asylum, now bands like Atmosphere, Jayhawks, just some really, really great, well-supported local bands. And mm-hmm. the local music is certainly part of the culture there, I think.
So, to back up a little bit then, since you mentioned 930 Club, did you have any connection to the D.C. hardcore scene then?
I was a big, any kind of hardcore I was into, especially from the East Coast, and the D.C. stuff, you know, obviously the Minor Threat stuff influenced the Youth of Today stuff, mm-hmm. and then, you know, and in the 90s, actually in the late 80s, I saw Fugazi play the 7th Street Entry in Minneapolis, and that was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And, you know, what they kind of, I felt like, in the 90s, Fugazi was sort of our Clash or something, you know? Like, if they were going to play, I had to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I even did a few road trips to go see them in different places. And they were an important band. They kind of, like, you know, felt like a band that were doing it sort of righteously and not as rah-rah positive as Youth of Today or even Minor Threat, but I felt like they're also kind of putting their money where their mouth was.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of benefit shows, activism, and keeping things cool for their fans, you know, and inexpensive and available, I guess. I don't know, you know, I imagine it was a great amount of work doing things the way they did things.
Yeah.
Know, keeping shows at $5 and inclusive and all ages. There's just so much.
Just renting out the gym and just tallying it up at the end. Have you've seen Instrument?
Yeah. You know, I will say that I was at a show, Fugazi show, in Minneapolis. There was a really bad fight at, and, you know, it was like, okay, well, I sort of wish we were at the club where there's good security right now, because this is kind of scary.
Yeah.
You know? But that's one of those things that, you know, you kind of have to, they had to almost self-police.
Yeah. You know, I'll never forget this. So Fugazi, I mentioned I grew up in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. There's Carnegie Mellon University's there.
Yeah.
Every year they do this thing called the Tech Fair. And I don't know what it's like these days, but back in, like, when I was growing up, like in grade school and high school, it was like pretty cool, and they would get like a real big fish or something, something like that. One year they got Fugazi.
Yeah.
In the afternoon Fugazi was gonna play, my cousin was getting married, and I like couldn't not go to the wedding, and it was in the same neighborhood, so I was literally outside of this church hearing Fugazi tuning their guitars and knowing I wasn't gonna
torture.
Be able to go.
That's torture.
I haven't had another jam since, man. This was almost like a decade and a half ago. So to close out, what's going to be coming up for you after this tour? Is it going to be more solo stuff? Is it going to be...
Yeah, I have a solo record that's going to come out in September. And we're going to tour on that in the fall. And that's the foreseeable future, you know. Hold Steady's taking a year off, you know. Hopefully we'll reconvene and make some music at some point. But right now it's this record and and the touring behind it. So
mm-hmm.
keeping busy. And that's sort of my thing. Like, I mean, that's always my thing. It's like just trying to get up and work, you know, whatever that means.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Well, what's the status of the new record then? Is it kind of... Is it a similar structure to the last one, like kind of bandy, but also kind of stripped down, or is it more stripped down, or is it?
It's less. I would say, it's similar, but a lot less. The last one I made in Austin, Texas, and it's with a band from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
This record is much less country, I would say, and maybe like a little more atmospheric. I made it up in Woodstock, and but it's still a very narrative record. There's all the songs are very very story oriented, and I think it's kind of a sparse record. I think we let the really tried to make the stories drive the songs, and hung music on when and where necessary. And I'm really proud of it. I think it's a unique record, and I can't wait for people to hear it.
I'm really looking forward to it too, Craig. Thanks for talking
Thank
to me,
you, man.
That was Craig Finn. For all of our Nashville listeners, Craig Finn will be at the Mercy Lounge Friday, June 12th. That show starts at 9 p.m. Doors open at 8. He'll be opening for the Heartless Bastards. Make sure you check that out. For all of our other listeners, to find out more about his solo tour, he'll be touring a lot. He's on tour right now. Go over to Craig Finn's Tumblr account, and you can find all that information there. This is Rob Placone. You've been listening to the Indie Bohemians Morning Show.